We're getting reaction from Capitol Hill as Russia's war against Ukraine enters its eighth day. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. President Biden, in his State of the Union speech Tuesday night, said Putin is now isolated from the world more than ever, and powerful economic sanctions are taking hold.
Tonight, I say to the Russian oligarchs and the corrupt leaders who bilk billions of dollars off this violent regime, no more.
Do you support the U.S. response to Russia's aggression? How do you want Congress to act? It's 800-642-1234. Republican U.S. Representative Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District in the northeastern part of our state serves on the House Armed Services Committee. Congressman Gallagher, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be with you.
Well, first, your assessment of the situation as Russia steps up assaults in major cities, explosions continue to rock Kyiv. Can Ukrainian resistance defeat Russia and not topple Ukraine's government?
Well, I think the Russians are going to continue to advance, notwithstanding the very real and inspiring bravery on display by the Ukrainians, whether it's the 13 border guards that, you know, stood up to a Russian warship, whether it's Zelensky himself leading from the front, failing or refusing to leave Kyiv, whether it's some of the pictures of grandmas we've seen picking up rifles to defend their hometowns. It's incredibly inspiring. I think it's stiff in the West, but I just don't think Putin's going to back down. And though his army thus far has failed to achieve a rapid victory that quickly collapses the will of the Ukrainians to fight, and though his occupation of the country is going to be costly and difficult, I fully expect him to continue. I expect him to use even more brutal tactics that we've seen previously on display in places like Aleppo and Grozny. So even in the best case scenario, I fear we're going to be dealing with both a massive humanitarian crisis in Europe, as well as the brutal reality that Putin will at least occupy some significant part of Ukraine, likely Kyiv and other key cities like Kharkiv and Odessa. And that's going to be very difficult. That means he's even closer to NATO's doorstep and in a better position to threaten the Baltic states and Poland. So I don't see this going away anytime soon. That's something we all need to think about, particularly those of us in public office, and draw the right lessons from this crisis going forward.
Well, let's talk about the role of the U.S., and we'll get to the humanitarian crisis in a moment. President Biden, in his State of the Union, announced he'll close American airspace to Russian planes.
And tonight, I'm announcing that we will join our allies in closing off American airspace to all Russian flights, further isolating Russia and adding additional squeeze on their economy.
So this announcement comes after Canada and European nations did the same. Do you agree with this move?
I do agree with the move. And I think you saw the bipartisan support for that on display at the State of the Union. The more controversial issue and what we're kind of arguing about right now in D.C., is the fact that notwithstanding some of the announcements of sanctions, for example, the Biden administration said they're going to sanction the central bank in Russia, and our European allies have taken even more aggressive measures. We've decided to sort of take some Russian banks off the SWIFT international banking transaction system. There's still a massive loophole and exemption for the Russian energy sector that allows them to continue to process payments for energy. European consumption of Russian natural gas has not changed. We are still buying Russian crude. Most people forget as well that Russia is a big producer of coal as well, and coal has actually gone to its highest price in at least a decade. I sort of checked this morning. You might have to check me on that. So the energy sector, if you really want to get serious about imposing economic costs on Putin, the general consensus is that you really have to go after their energy sector. And we're still not doing that, at least in an aggressive fashion, with this massive exemption. And that is due in part to the fear of how that might affect Americans at the pump.
I want to pause right there, because some House Democrats have floated a proposal to end normal trade relations with Russia and the U.S. policy of treating Russia as a most favored nation, remove Russia from the World Trade Organization. In light of these sanctions, how do you feel about that?
Well, President Biden promised to turn Putin into an international pariah. In general, I think that's a good idea. Now, I'd have to look specifically at the bill you've referenced. I haven't seen it, quite honestly. But there are steps we can do to further isolate Russia internationally, reduce the role of Russia in various international fora, the World Trade Organization being one of them. I also think it's a mistake to be relying on the Russians to negotiate with Iran, as we are doing right now in Vienna in an attempt to revive the 2015 Iran deal, because the Iranians refused to negotiate with us directly. That doesn't really add up in my mind. How could we be turning Putin into a pariah while we're also working with him to negotiate with the Iranians? And the State Department spokesman said, well, we will continue to work with Russia on areas of mutual interest, and negotiating over the Iranian nuclear program is one of them. So if they get a deal, are we going to be standing on the stage with Lavrov? Either you're committed to turning Putin into a pariah or you're not. And I am open very much to working with my Democratic colleagues in the House to figuring out creative ways where we can further isolate Vladimir Putin, who's shown that he's a KGB thug and a barbarian. And we'll stop at nothing in order to write his name into the history books, even if he's writing it with the blood of innocent people. It's a very dangerous situation. And so I will go and reach out to my Democratic colleagues who introduced that bill and analyze it. And hopefully we can find a bipartisan path forward. I mean, I was inspired by some of the bipartisan display after the president's remarks. I welcome some of the comments from our German allies about investing in their own defense, figuring out a way to provide lethal assistance to the Ukrainians. But thus far, this has been a lot of talk. We still need to see these words put into action on the ground. And obviously, I continue to disagree with some of my Democratic colleagues about their energy policies, which I fear are playing into Putin's hands right now.
Congressman Mike Gallagher represents Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District, covering Green Bay, Fox Valley. You can join in. What would you like to see Congress do to address the Russian invasion of Ukraine? 800-642-1234. In recent days, we have talked with the head of the Wisconsin National Guard, Paul Knapp, said on our program that the Guard currently has troops stationed in Eastern European NATO countries. What is the risk of U.S. troops entering a direct conflict with Russia?
Well, right now, the administration is committed to making sure they don't enter into a direct conflict and there won't be troops on the ground in Ukraine. I don't want to minimize the risk if they're in a nearby country, but if Putin were to attack U.S. troops stationed in a NATO ally country, obviously he'd be escalating dramatically. He'd be crossing the Article 5 provision of NATO, which would trigger our collective defense. And so I doubt he's willing to go that far. That being said, this is a man who threatened the use of nuclear weapons recently and raised his nuclear alert to the second of four levels that they have in the country, which I view as a move just to intimidate NATO, and we must not be intimidated. So these troops will primarily be used, my understanding is, in two ways. One, just to bolster our presence in NATO's eastern front and deter Putin from going further and attacking NATO directly. Of course, Ukraine is not a NATO ally, but as well, logistically, to make sure that we can continue to flow support to the Ukrainians on the ground that are fighting. And I think NATO is fairly united right now in wanting to continue to provide lethal assistance. Somewhat famously now, Zelensky said when offered, evacuation by America from the country, I don't need a ride, I need ammunition. Mm-hmm. And I think our job is to ensure that he has the ammunition he needs in the form of javelins, stingers, body armor, sniper rifles, mines. These are things that can make it very difficult for Putin over the long term. And that is what we must do. So we need to turn this into a quagmire for him, something similar to the way in which the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979, though a brilliant conventional move initially, ultimately turned into a decade-long quagmire that expedited the fall of the Soviet Union. We should be imposing as many costs on the ground on Putin as possible, especially in light of the fact that we now see that the Russian army has significant logistical problems, maintenance problems, resupply problems, and overestimated, or rather underestimated, the will of the Ukrainians to fight.
Getting reaction from U.S. Congressman Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin about Moscow's goal to oust Ukraine's democratically elected government and what the role of the U.S. should be. You can join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Congressman Mike Gallagher here on the Ideas Network. The head of the World Health Organization says it's seeking a humanitarian corridor to be opened to Ukraine since pre-positioned supplies in Kyiv are inaccessible. First shipment of medical supplies arriving in neighboring Poland today. We're getting a reaction from Congress on Russia's war on Ukraine. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. How should the U.S. punish Russia? Do you think the U.S. should supply weapons to Ukraine to battle the Russian invasion? Do you worry about potential cyber attacks on U.S. businesses? 800-642-1234. U.S. Representative Mike Gallagher with us for about nine more minutes. Let's look at the humanitarian crisis. 1 million people now fled across the borders of Ukraine since the invasion started. That's from the UN's top refugee official on Twitter yesterday. The UN estimates 4 million Ukrainian refugees will need protection in the coming months. That's more than two-thirds of the total population of Wisconsin. What should the U.S. do for refugees?
Well, clearly, we're going to have to ensure that the refugees have, you know, the basic essentials. We're going to have to work with our allies to provide food, water, and shelter. I think the broader question is sort of where do these refugees go over the long term? And I'd be lying to you if I said I had an easy answer to that. My hope is that we can draw the line in Western Ukraine and ensure that there's at least, you know, a functioning government in Lviv and a place for Ukrainians to stay within their own country or near their own country. But all of that depends on how much assistance and military assistance we're able to get on the ground in Ukraine and whether the sanctions we're putting in place now have an actual deterrent effect on Putin and whether we're able to amplify some of the dissent that he's experiencing from some of the more powerful oligarchs within Russia, but as well as the dissatisfaction among the Russian people. So it's a very fluid situation. As I said at the beginning of this interview, I fear it's going to get worse. You know, I think the lesson over the long term is just the costs of deterrence failure. I think the fact that we failed to deter Putin, and now we're going to have to spend billions of dollars dealing with this, and tens of thousands of people are going to lose their lives, should be a sobering lesson for us. To me, it's obvious that sanctions alone cannot deter. You know, hashtag diplomacy alone cannot deter. And I think where this lesson really needs to be learned is in a different part of the world, in the Indo-Pacific, particularly when it comes to Taiwan. We know that General Secretary Xi Jinping, who's broadly supporting Putin, they signed a kind of 5,000-word statement of mutual cooperation, saying nothing was off limits, the potential for friendship was endless. His legacy issue, what he wants to do, is invade Taiwan or take over Taiwan, preferably with non-lethal means, but with the military if necessary.
So what is China's responsibility then in this crisis with Ukraine?
I don't think China views itself as having any responsibility. I think the fundamental, beyond the deterrence failure, perhaps the more fundamental mistake we've made leading up to this crisis is what I would call mirror imaging. We think people like Putin and Xi play by the same rules that we in the West do. We think that they respect what we call the international order. They don't. They live in a world where might makes right, where people don't have individual rights, where it's all about the power of the party or the power of Putin himself. And a failure to understand that blinds us, I think, to the truly evil designs of these countries. And so I think China does not view itself as having any responsibilities in this crisis and is focused on continuing to pursue its long-term objective, which is to displace the United States in the Indo-Pacific as well as globally.
Before we move on, I just want to put a finer point here, because you and your colleagues are talking about what size of aid package makes sense for Ukraine. Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia said earlier this week he's heard as much as $10 billion. What is the right amount of humanitarian aid from the U.S.?
Well, the number that was floated this week was a $6 billion package that was mostly military assistance, which makes sense to me. Whether the $10 billion figure is that plus humanitarian assistance, I'd have to check with Senator Kaine, but it is going to be costly. And again, it gets to the point of just how costly and bloody things get when deterrence fails. I was very disappointed yesterday, I'll say. We passed a resolution on the House floor, which I voted for, and I agree with what's in that resolution, and it passed almost unanimously, but it was a resolution. It was just words on a page. It wasn't actually
non-binding,
moving money. Yeah, and it didn't move money or material assistance anywhere near Ukraine. You know, we're 6 months into the fiscal year. We haven't passed a defense budget of our own. I do think the president missed an opportunity in the State of the Union to talk about the need to actually pass a defense budget, because another lesson we have to learn is the need to invest in our own defense. You know, you mentioned something that I think is very important leading into this segment. You mentioned the risk of cyber attacks. I've spent the last 2 years co-chairing a commission on U.S. cyber policy. I can tell you our homeland is vulnerable to cyber attacks. And I do think that if this situation escalates, Putin will not hesitate to attack our critical infrastructure. There's a space where we need to be investing more in our own defense to make us more resilient to cyber attacks. And given the fact that 80% of our critical infrastructure is owned by the private sector, it's an area where the private sector has to step up and work in partnership with a more nimble federal government to defend the homeland. That's how Putin can launch an attack on our own territory. He doesn't need to actually physically cross the border. He can do it with cyber weapons.
Pausing there with Mike Gallagher, represents Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District. Let's take a call now. We have Jerry in Pittsville. Jerry, hi.
Hi there. I got to be honest. I'm almost flabbergasted at our congressman and with the leadership in D.C. in general. We're sitting here. I'm driving down the road in a semi right now. I bust my rear end 50, 60 hours a week, every week, moving stuff this country, and I just listen to these people talk flippantly about 50, 60, 70 million dollars in aid package. Where our country has
and Jerry, you are breaking up as you move in your semi. Jerry, just very concerned, as you can hear, that we are sending so much money. And Jerry had said, why does the U.S. have to be the world police?
That's a great question. And I think it represents the frustration a lot of Americans feel when faced with crisis like this. I just would say, if you look at American history, when we've tried to retreat into Fortress America, when we've tried to tell ourselves that we don't have to invest in our own defense or maintain a forward posture and maintain robust alliances, it's usually resulted in catastrophic world war. That's ironically and tragically forced us to spend more on our defense over the long term. So I actually think the most cost-effective way to make sure we don't waste money is to have a credible deterrent, invest in our defense, invest in lethal allies to ensure that people like Putin don't try something like this, so that we don't have to spend money mitigating the effects. As the old saying goes, problems don't age well. And that's as true in your personal life as it is in geopolitics. Now, I don't know if this is where Jerry was going, but I will say, I do think our counterproductive energy policy, and he said he's driving a truck right now, and the war this administration has waged on domestic energy production, the cancellation of the Keystone Pipeline, which cost us 10,000 Wisconsin jobs, is a needless cost that now Wisconsinites are going to have to bear. High oil prices, what Wisconsin is going to pay at the pump, that's not just due to Putin. That's due to our own counterproductive policy. So that's an area where I think we can do more to alleviate the costs so that Jerry and others don't have to pay for this day to day in Wisconsin. But I just would argue that the more we ignore these problems, you know, whether it's the problem posed by Putin or Xi Jinping, I mean, we're just going to find ourselves dealing with a much greater crisis. Or, and I'll stop here, if we talk about the economic impact of this, I mean, Putin has leverage over the global energy markets, given that, you know, Russia's position, particularly with respect to natural gas. But China has so much more economic leverage. And if we ignore the threat posed by China, they're going to hold us hostage for the next 100 years if they have control of chip production, for example. So, you know, I wish we could just only invest domestically. I just don't think we have that luxury in the modern economy.
Thank you for joining us, Congressman Gallagher.
Thank you.
U.S. Representative Mike Gallagher, Republican from Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District, serves on the House Armed Services Committee. News update is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about an herbal supplement that is sold as an energy booster, mood enhancer, pain reliever, and more. We're finding out what the medical community has to tell us about kratom. You might also call it kratom. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is an extract from the leaves of an evergreen tree grown in Southeast Asia. State lawmakers had considered a bill this session to legalize it. Do you know of kratom or have tried it? Do you turn to natural remedies for pain? It's 800-642-1234. Dr. Ritu Bhatnagar is an addiction psychiatrist and medical co-director of the New Start Addiction Service at Unity Health Meritor. She is president of the Wisconsin Society of Addiction Medicine. Dr. Bhatnagar, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, introduce us to kratom and how this extract affects the body. What can you tell us?
Sure. Before I do that, I just want to add a couple of things about myself. I have also a public health degree, and I'm a parent and a member of my community. So my perspective that you're going to hear today is informed by all of these experiences.
Thank you.
And I want to be really clear that as we continue talking today, that any views I express are mine and not those of my employer.
Very good. Thank you so much for that.
So my approach to understanding kratom is grounded in principles that are from a fact-based public health and safety standpoint. I am primarily interested in the health of my patients and our community. So from that approach, kratom is, as you mentioned, it's a tropical tree that's native to Southeast Asia, and the leaves contain compounds that do have the psychotropic or mind-altering effects. And there are different varieties of it. The research is not clear yet about the differences in these varieties.
So when did you hear about it, see it? How did it come to you as you in your practice?
Sure. So I actually heard about it first at a addiction psychiatry conference in 2013 as an emerging health concern for addiction professionals. And then I went back and started looking more into this and found out that we know it's been gaining popularity in the U.S. since 2011 because of reports to poison control and admissions to hospitals.
And you mentioned 2013, it became illegal in Wisconsin in that year. Is there an illegal market, do you see, for this health extract?
So this is a very interesting question because the legality of a substance is something that is decided by lawmakers. The health and safety concerns are my purview and my interest.
Mm-hmm.
As an addiction psychiatrist, I take care of people who are using all sorts of substances, some legal, some illegal. And so, yes, to answer your question, it appears by the very virtue of the fact that it's illegal here in Wisconsin, there is an illegal market for it.
What do you think the role should be of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in this moment? There are no FDA-approved uses for kratom. The agency has received concerning reports about the safety of it. And their commissioner for regulatory affairs last May said, quote, "There is substantial concern regarding the safety of kratom, the risk it may pose to public health, and its potential for abuse." What do you want to see out of the FDA?
From this is a very interesting perspective and a question with far-reaching questions and answers too. If the longer that we look at it, the more that we start to uncover about how all of these agencies work. I would really like to see some very clear guidelines and guidance that is based on public health, the science, and the evidence, and not supporting or influenced unduly by corporate interests or lobbying firms.
If you're just joining us, we're discussing kratom, this health extract, with Dr. Ritu Bhatnagar. She's an addiction psychiatrist, president of the Wisconsin Society of Addiction Medicine. Have you ever taken kratom? Should kratom be legalized in Wisconsin? How should healthcare providers balance the potential risks to public health? 800-642-1234 to join in. So can you explain a little bit? There's been, a long list of things that this herbal extract has claims of, like relieving pain, enhancing mood, reducing opioid withdrawal. Does kratom do these things?
And again, much of what we know about kratom is anecdotal and also some science-based. And so I will review with you what I know about it from both of these, as well as from reputable sources like the National Institutes of Drug Abuse, that is a taxpayer-funded, transparent organization. Looked at and stated very clearly on their website about it that at low doses, kratom has stimulant-like properties, like cocaine. At higher doses, it has opioid-like properties, like opium. It can also cause uncomfortable and sometimes dangerous side effects, like both cocaine and opium together. So all of this depends on the person and the dose. It's not as clear-cut as sometimes the representation of it in the media can be.
I think I had, on the stimulant effects, I think I had read some comparisons to coffee. Can you draw any parallels there?
So it is in the same general botanical category as the coffee plant. And so that is, I think, how those comparisons get drawn. In terms of its impact on the brain, it's a quite different compound than caffeine. From coffee, we know that there are a lot of different chemicals that make up kratom, the plant, and we are just starting to learn more about these things. It has been researched for many years. The active compound was actually identified in the 20s in the West.
In the 1920s?
That's right. It was, from a Western standpoint, a Dutch botanist actually described it in 1839, but it's been used in Thailand for many years before that. So we've continued to learn more since then, since the 20s, when mitragynine, which was identified as one of the active compounds in it, and more research was put into it in the 60s and 70s because people were looking for new pain relief methods, and so more has been even learned about it. Different compounds within it have been identified as the science has been able to look at it since the 1990s. And each layer of this intriguing plant tells us that there are lots of different effects that we are just learning about. So we do not know everything about it. The pharmacology is not clearly understood at this point. I just want to be very clear about that.
Yes. How would you describe the state of the research today? And what do you find intriguing yourself about this plant?
Well, what I find intriguing about it is that people are assuming when they come in, and I hear about it from the people I take care of, that they think it is helping their opioid withdrawal. They think that it is something that is beneficial to them. And my concern is that they could really just be replacing one addiction with another. And that's part of the intriguing part to me, is that in the lower doses, as I said, had those stimulating properties, the higher doses, opioid-like properties, and the sort of effective dose that we're looking for in people is not clearly known. So for me to be able to advise people about it is very challenging, because it is the individual response is going to vary significantly, and there is a lot of variation in response as well as side effect to this compound.
How do people ingest it most commonly?
It's used most commonly, according to NIDA, as a pill and capsule or extract form. And again, in this form, it's really hard to know. It's just a powder that you see in the capsule, a brown powder. So it's hard to know what variety of plant it originated from or the country of origin even. And some people chew the leaves or brew the leaves as a tea.
So that would be really problematic to know exactly what it is you're ingesting, since there are varieties of this plant, and certainly you may not even know the strength of what it is.
That's exactly my concern from a medical standpoint, and it's sometimes even sold as a green powder in packets labeled not for human consumption or mixed in with bath salts or other herbal supplements. And sometimes the ingredients, as we know, on those herbal supplements are not clearly delineated. And there's real concern about there being contamination with heavy metals and other contaminants in the plants when they are processed. We don't know anything about how they're being processed, in what capacity, or how they're being distributed either.
So as you describe it first being described in the 1839, 1920s, there's more research about it. What do you want researchers to look at today? What should be the focal point of trying to understand kratom?
You know, I think the science, that we have the capacity to start to understand it. Do we have the bandwidth, and do we have the unbiased funding to do it? So we know in psychiatry, psychedelics that were just a decade or two ago considered off limits, like ketamine, psilocybin, MDMA, they are being studied for their scientific effect, mechanism, and safety to treat bona fide conditions that people are struggling with and suffering from. We're now developing protocols using these hallucinogenics, as they're called now, and psychedelics. We're researching this and developing protocols and really studying everything from the pharmacology to the pharmacokinetics within the human body. And we are using these effectively and finding that there is a benefit. So when kratom is similarly studied, I think we can use what we've been doing in science with ketamine and psilocybin and MDMA and use that same sort of scrutiny and rigorous scientific research to study kratom in the same way and see where would its use be appropriate and how as a treatment for what society is struggling with.
So what I'm hearing from you is that it should really follow a similar path that researchers have taken with psychedelic drugs and hallucinogenic compounds. Is that right?
That's right. That rigorous scientific research is needed. And, you know, if I felt that kratom would be an effective tool right now in our fight with the opioid epidemic, I would be a strong advocate for it. Mm. But I don't think the science is there yet. In fact, there are concerning reports about its safety.
Addiction psychiatrist Ritu Bhatnagar explaining health effects of the supplement kratom, where researchers are at with it. Should the Food and Drug Administration crack down on kratom for medicinal and therapeutic uses? Should kratom be legalized in Wisconsin or not? Did you weigh in on the state legislation recently and the push to legalize it? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Bhatnagar here on the Ideas Network. The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA, has listed kratom as a drug and chemical of concern. We're learning about kratom with perspective from a physician on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The DEA's description says the leaves from the tropical tree kratom in Southeast Asia causes stimulant and sedative effects in different doses. Are you familiar with kratom? What do you want to know about its effects on the body? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Dr. Ritu Bhatnagar leads the Wisconsin Society of Addiction Medicine and is with us for about 9 more minutes. Dr. Bhatnagar, we also heard from Maddie in De Pere, called in, couldn't stay with us. And Maddie was wondering about who is promoting, who's pushing the legalization of kratom. And I know that enters the political realm, which is politics, is not the focus of medicine, obviously. But what concerns you about the possibility of the legalization of kratom in Wisconsin?
Thank you for that question, Maddie. That is actually a very important and healthy question to be asking. Where is the push for the legalization coming from? We know that there is an American Kratom Association that has been very active in drafting legislation and been very effective in getting some of that legislation passed in many different states. My concern is that they're not promoting an unbiased perspective or all the facts that we are finding out from a medical community and a medical perspective from the literature. It started with case reports. Now we have quite a few. There's even been a coining of the term kratom use disorder based on the challenges that we've seen. And this is information that is not getting into the public sphere. And so my concern is that in the push to legalize this substance without effective information, without enough and sufficient information about its safety, we are really putting public health well below the concern for corporate interests and profits. And I agree, medicine does not do much with politics historically. However, when I am taking care of a person and I see that things are happening around me and in their lives are being affected by policies, from a medical standpoint, that is the place from which I advocate for my patients. And so I think it's actually very, very important to pay attention to where is the push coming from? Where is the funding coming from?
Are there other substances like kratom that have other pushes, other special interests that are backing a substance before the research catches up? Is kratom unique?
Well, we could say historically, looking at tobacco, for instance, there was a push for that. And more recently, we have found out that the clear and present dangers of tobacco are very well known. Nobody contests that, but it was not a part of that that plant, that product that was made clear to people. The same can be said for the cannabis and marijuana legislation that's been coming down the pike as well. Where is the data for its safety? As I know we were talking about kratom and not marijuana, so I'm going to redirect a little bit. But my concern is that we've seen this time and again where public health interests and becomes a partisan concern. And I haven't quite figured out why public health and safety are political issues and not something that we are able to decouple and really think about how do we take care of the health of our population as the starting point for any law.
Let's bring on a call now. Joe is joining us from Eau Claire. Joe, hi, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I vehemently disagree with your guest's position on illegalizing kratom. It is by far and away much safer as an opiate alternative than other substances that addicts can't resort to. And it just creates a larger black market for unhealthy more unhealthy or unhealthier situations.
Sure. Situations for example, people take.
For example, right now there's a huge fentanyl problem in the United States. The Chinese could make it very cheaply, and they started pressing their fentanyl in the form of OxyContin pills. They look identical to OxyContin, except sometimes they're a different color. And because addicts have to go to illicit and sometimes unethical drug dealers, to get their substances, it doesn't come with a warning label saying this is not OxyContin.
And it's so fentanyl. We should and be focusing more on these dangerous substances. I want to get the reaction of Dr. Bhatnagar. What would you make of what Joe is saying there?
Well, you know, as an addiction psychiatrist, I am all too familiar with the opioid epidemic and the influence of fentanyl into the current supply of many substances, not just opioids. It's a very, very dangerous time. And my heart absolutely goes out to this society right now and to the people that are in my community, because I have been all too familiar with death as the outcome, often involving people that are far too healthy and far too young. So I absolutely hear the concern that Joe is expressing about the safety of the drugs that are out there for people who are struggling with addiction. What I want to back up, though, and say is that it's very, very important to know and state very clearly, we do have effective FDA-approved medications that are safe, have been studied, and are available to treat opioid addiction right now. Mm. It's really a matter of access to this treatment. So I know that when people are struggling and they are looking for any solution, this is what ends up happening, is a lot of families are already struggling. They're really desperate. They're looking for anything. And my concern is that the way that the marketing is happening is it's really preying on this desperation for an easy fix. And I feel like it's not an easy fix. It comes with its very own real and present dangers. There, in fact, have been reports very clearly of overdoses involving kratom alone. But also in combination with other substances. So the idea that it is safer is not, I don't think it's a valid argument from which to start talking about legalization. It's about how do we get people access to the treatments that we know are safe and effective and already out there.
Dr. Bhatnagar, thank you so much for this conversation. Thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this issue. I think the society has looked for happiness in a lot of different ways, and we get it confused with pleasure. And this is something that if we can help people think a little bit differently about their suffering, that they are very real and that they're experiencing, but how can we find a different way through this and not resort to a fad? Every few years, we hear there's a new cure for cancer or something else, but I think we really want to adopt an attitude of healthy skepticism so that we don't get swayed by the hopes, but stay grounded in the science.
Dr. Ritu Bhatnagar, addiction psychiatrist, president of the Wisconsin Society of Addiction Medicine. If you or someone needs help, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration runs a free confidential hotline. That number is 1-800-662-HELP. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.